Hello and welcome to the Art Monthly talk show. I'm Chris McCormack, Associate Editor of the magazine, and today I'm joined by writer and curator Vaishna Sergid, independent scholar Amna Malik, and writer and critic Henry Broom. Henry will be talking about homelessness, sanitation, and public art. Amna reports on Pavan Dekor's current exhibition, Nothing is Fixed, at Hansel Gallery in Southampton. But first we start with Vaishna, who reviews Samia Sankar-Bose's exhibition, Braiding Dusk and Dawn, at the Delfina Foundation in London, which ends on July 7th. The artist is shown in the US and India and was part of the Belfast Photo Festival last year, and his current show at Delfina being his first in London. I wondered if we might begin, Vaishna, by firstly outlining the newly commissioned video work for his show, for this show, and your initial reactions to it.
Yeah, so... the newly commissioned work, Things We Lost Last Night,
yeah,
kind of comes out of his residency in Delfina, I think, which was in 2022, where he undertook a lot of archival research. And I guess a really important part of the whole exhibition is how he's looking into his own family history. So in 1969, I think it is, his mother, at the age of 9, went missing. She went to a sweet shop to buy some sweets as an offering, and she disappeared for somewhere between 2 to 3 years. And it's not entirely clear what happened, and she can't remember what happened to her. And even within the family, they can't all remember exactly how long she was gone for. And in that time period, Boss's grandfather, so her mother, her father passed away. So they never got to meet again. The newly commissioned work is kind of thinking, it's sort of from the perspective of the kind of grown-up woman of his mother, and it's not a speculative diary of what might have happened, but rather her kind of coming back and everything that happened afterwards. But it's also really heavily interspersed with what was going on in West Bengal at the time, and so he very much sees his family history as tied into the kind of leftist struggles at the time. And I wonder if it's helpful to kind of have a bit of context on what was going on in West Bengal.
Yeah, I think that would be very useful, actually.
Yeah. So West Bengal is an eastern state in India that borders with Bangladesh. It's fairly, it's not small, but it's geographically not huge, but quite heavily populated. And around this time in the late 60s, there's massive political change in India. There's kind of, for the artist, the kind of 1967 elections were really important. So this is all like 2 years before his mother disappeared. There's also kind of the kind of emergence of the Naxalite movement, which they are a militant communist separatist movement. And it emerges in West Bengal in a village where there's a kind of particular peasant uprising. And obviously it's important to say this is very much the result of lots of long-standing factors and things that were inherited from the colonial policies as well, but that's seen as like a bit of a catalyst. So there's a lot of this kind of violence, both guerrilla warfare going on at the time and state violence at the time. So when the artist was kind of doing more research in Delfina for his residency, he starts to understand that what happened to his mother wasn't a kind of singular incident, and actually lots of children were going missing and there was a lot of widespread violence at this time. So that piece, which is a three-channel work, is kind of pulling together all of these different memories and archival research that he did. And it's very complicated in some ways, looking at British colonial newspapers or police records brings its own issues, as well as talking to his mother, grandmother, members of his community. And then what emerges is this very hazy patchwork of different memories in this film, and it's incredibly beautiful but also deeply harrowing. Some of the immediate things that come up when you watch the film is about the smell of death. Mm. And I think it's so powerful. And it's interesting, the whole thing is really sensory. It's also a very long film. It's about 59 minutes. Mm. And you're kind of, you know, being like slammed constantly with all of this violence and these memories that don't quite make sense and don't really form a narrative, because that's not really possible. So he's very much thinking about thinking about history in a particular way that's not trying to be prescriptive. And there's this total acceptance that he can't tell us what happened to his mother, but also to all of these people and all of the unrecorded violence that he's kind of referring to at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, my understanding of it, I mean, I briefly watched it in sections, is the sense of almost a disordered relation to these histories is the only way in which a potential story might emerge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also in these kind of stories of resistant fighters or what happened to these particular women or families that are around this time that kind of are that's interspersed throughout the film, there's definite sense of how it felt in your body to experience those things. So as a the what I was saying about the smell of death, she talks about coming back to the village and she's used to seeing. She was familiar with death, but she forgot about the spell of it. And immediately it starts kind of, you start trying to feel that. There's another episode that's quite difficult. We hear about someone kind of having forced to eat blood. And I felt like I could feel that in my mouth afterwards as I was writing it. He wrote the script, I think, largely while he was doing his residency. And I think it's actually quite amazing how he kind of managed to piece that together and the way that he's decided to develop on things. It's not just that X and Y happened at this time, but what did it feel like to experience that? And what did it feel like to hear it and see it and smell it? Which I guess really allows him to expand what's ultimately very visual. So often, like, we don't see death, but we hear about it so much and we hear about how it felt. And I think that's really powerful.
And can you say something? Do you know much more about his research process? I know he was researching here at the British Library, but do you know anything further about what that led or what that yielded in terms of his work?
So I think he obviously this story has been part of his family for a long time, and he's always known that. And for the majority of his career, I don't think he felt necessarily ready to tackle the what's quite a difficult subject. And I heard him speak, and he explained that during the pandemic, he really used that as an opportunity when he was with all of his family. They'd all had COVID. I think his grandmother had been in hospital for quite a while. He wanted to learn everything from them and start piecing this together. So I think it very much started from within his family, and then he started expanding, speaking to other people in the community. And he's also very conscious of everyone in his family has kind of different perspective of what happened. They all have different memories. And obviously we're talking about things that happened over 50, 60 years ago. So there's the instability of all of their memories. And I think when he was in Delfina, that's when he started looking into maybe more. Like, I think there was a lot of newspaper research. And of course, you can find lots of intelligence and police records as well. So I kind of see his process as something that's quite hybrid. I don't think he's necessarily picking one as the, I guess, ultimately at the center of all of this is his family history. But even that is confused. And the whole thing is very dazed experience, which I think probably is how he was experiencing, if I can speak for him, experiencing kind of doing this research.
And can we say something about the way in which he stages these ideas of memory itself?
There's another piece in the exhibition called A Discreet Exit Through Darkness, which is a VR kind of headset. And that is from the perspective of his grandfather in the years that his mother went missing. I think that started as a photography project, and he went to all of these places that his grandfather might have gone to look for his mum, and instead realized that it needed some movement. And so you put the headset on, and you're sort of stuck in each of these different locations, looking around the way his grandfather might have done. And we hear this kind of voice behind us that's talking, which is supposed to be his grandfather, which he is the actor, that he's the voice actor on that. And so there's that kind of darkness, and that is supposed to be a very claustrophobic experience. And then even more broadly in the gallery, it's very darkened. And there's something about the space at Delfina. You walk down, you descend into it. It feels like you're going into the like belly of the gallery. And the whole space is darkened. And there are also some photographs. So that's the like third component of the exhibition. And they are printed. I think they might even be vinyls. They're not framed and they're stuck to the wall. But because it's dark, you need to use a torch to find them. So again, the whole exhibition is like in darkness, very much, I think, how that very much relates to his relationship with memory and how he's thinking about what's going on. He very much is kind of forcing you to experience this kind of searching. that I think is kind of time and time again is in the three-channel film in the VR work, and then you're searching for the photos as well and trying to see them. So it's all clearly quite designed to have that experience of confinement and darkness.
Maestro, can I ask something about the torch? At the South London Gallery show of Pope Owl, which was, I think that was last year, and spanned into February, there were darkened rooms in which you had to kind of navigate with torches, and you would oftentimes be led by other visitors, or they would like hand you a torch. Did you like follow other people, or was it a kind of solo experience?
I think it was a solo experience. It's funny actually, because so when I went down, they told me you can take a torch here or you can just use your phone. And I almost felt a bit awkward taking the torch. And I thought, oh no, I should do it. I should do this properly. I should commit to the experience. I felt odd doing it and kind of like holding a torch and looking around, almost like you're on a kind of treasure hunt. And there is this fear. There's this total fear that you don't know what the photos are of at all. And if you've watched the film, you kind of are worried it's going to be something quite difficult and violent as well. I wonder if you went with another person, maybe the two of you would kind of work together. I did it alone. Right. I'm not sure it the whole thing feels very solitary in a way. Like with the VR, you have to do that yourself. You've got to put the headset on yourself. And I think that it's very much a kind of, it feels like a solo experience, definitely, I think.
Interesting. As you also said, I think the way in which the light falls upon the photographs that have been placed onto the walls, there's a kind of partial account or only a partial viewing of what the history might reveal or what we might see. I think that feels like an integral part of that. I think what's interesting is that seeming contradiction with that, and also then the idea of a VR experience, which is about supposedly 360. I think there's an interesting, maybe what on one level feels like a contradiction of an experience, but actually it's kind of interesting to think of them together.
I think so. I think because there's this kind of two-ness to the whole thing of trying to find out what's happened, but also accepting that there is no way that you can really achieve that. So you can look, you can go in the 360, but even that has its limitations. That's also a very long piece. I think it's over 50 minutes. And so, you know, you realize, you know the story by now, so you know he's not going to find her. And the scenes keep reappearing. So you know we've already been here, she's not here, and that you're forced to keep doing that. And I guess that's something that really, it's such a sticking point, this kind of sense that you're worried of what you're going to find, but you also know you can't find it all.
Could I ask something about that? It was wonderful reading your review, and I thought you wrote so beautifully about the work. I mean, this, what I suppose the question I have is around affect, and how sort of contested that is because of the sense of whose emotions are being mobilized and how we bring, to what extent we're bringing our own kind of history to bear when we become overwhelmed. And I mean, some of what you wrote I just found so moving, and also, you know, very hard as well, and that always comes up for me, is that if I'm being moved, am I imposing my own emotional kind of baggage onto work? Is there a sense of how Bose manages and negotiates those sorts of dynamics, which must be difficult when it's also very personal, and how that's being transmitted to outside of the family?
Yeah, absolutely. I just, on that last point, it's definitely interesting having the works displayed in London, obviously very far from West Bengal. Most people don't know where that is. Not that they necessarily should, but they just don't, and they don't know these histories. So I think it kind of, there's a lot to say about how he is drawing on all of these different experiences. I think it was interesting listening to him talk actually about how he's not really, as most artists I think say, you know, they're not trying to represent communities, but I'm also conscious this is his community. These are the people that he's grown up with. This is his family. And so I think there is this line of, he you know, he does get to kind of say how he feels and how his mother might feel as well. I'd also say the films aren't, the three-channel film especially, it's not concrete necessarily. It's not trying to put words in anybody's mouth.
Sure.
And I think that obviously that's got this kind of, there's a sense that you bring what you want to it as well, because he's not necessarily telling you what to feel about it. But sometimes I think that's the point, you know, to, I can't imagine anybody watching any of these films and not having an emotional response to it. You know, that wouldn't be, it's so difficult. And I think you're supposed to have those feelings, and also you're supposed to think, you know, it makes you think about what's happening in the world and this kind of violence and what may, he's not necessarily telling us, you know, go and do something about it, but that's kind of always implied, I think, in these sort of, in these works. The kind of three-channel work, I feel like you're kind of constantly overwhelmed with all of these different things, and it's a very difficult experience. But like I was saying before, I wonder if that's what it felt like doing the research for it. You know, what was it like to speak to his, you know, grandmother during a pandemic about his mother's disappearance? What was it like to read his mother's diaries, look at his father's photographs? I imagine all of that to be incredibly painful and disorientating. And so it, to me, actually, the experience makes a lot of sense, even if it doesn't, you know, I can't necessarily understand all of these different people's approaches and histories, but I can at least get a sense of how he might feel from doing this kind of work.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Vashna, for that. Maybe we'll move on to Amna now, who's reviewed Amanda Kaur's exhibition at the Hansard Gallery in Southampton. The exhibition is called
Nothing is Fixed.
Nothing is Fixed. Thank you for that. And in a way, it brings together longstanding themes, I feel, for Pamanda. I remember seeing her work many years ago, and it feels very much following a kind of line of thinking that she's been working on for many years. I wanted to ask you, when was the first time you encountered her work, actually?
It's so difficult. I feel like I've known her forever. In different ways, so it's really hard to remember the first time, but I think that certainly I think there was a show in East London in the late 90s where she was making these sort of felt figures, and I think my colleague Urelle Andrews wrote about that work, and it was in the context of a kind of phenomenological set of things that the sense of the body and sculpture, we know that history around minimalism and its engagement with the spectator's body in the gallery. So that, I think that was kind of my first sense of her work as an artist, and how she was sort of kind of playing with materials, but also with the theme of childhood. And what I recall about that work was there were also, it's because she's Sikh, that there were sort of these little figurines with sort of small kind of golden daggers in these sorts of quite elaborate kind of fabric structures that suggest a kind of Mughal kind of history, you know. So it's kind of, there was always a sense that she's drawing on the specificity of a Sikh heritage in India, but sort of also engaging with, you know, quite kind of European debates around fabrication, sculpture, embodiment, you know. Mm.
Yeah, I think the first time I came across her work was actually the Blue Coat Gallery in 96, I think. Yes, very, very young student. I remember it quite vividly because I think I was invigilating the show. It's nice to see the work actually after all these years again. I feel like there was a time when I don't think I remember seeing much of her work, but it feels like in the past 5 or 6 years, we're seeing more of her again, which is good to see.
I think she took time out and then has come back. And the work that is in the show that I had seen before was part of an exhibition at Nottingham, I think it's New Art Exchange in around 20, 2012, 2013, which is the camouflage series. And so those are pieces where they're all arranged along one wall, and they sort of, that was a departure from the felt. So for a long time, she was just working with these sort of felt that have these associations with the nursery and with children's toys. But with the camouflage series, I think she was, a lot of it was sort of patterned silk that was very reminiscent of Indian sort of cloth and fabric for, you know, saris or dresses or that kind of thing, very sort of elaborate silk patterned, quite luxurious fabrics. And so that was an interesting shift away from what she'd been working on before. And the exhibition at John Hanser sort of situates that, but then she's brought in some other pieces. So the sort of camouflage series, she's taken that kind of the figure of the child and the sort of silhouetted felt fabric, and then sort of making it almost hollow and putting it onto a kind of frame, so that there's this play on this figure on ground, which is obviously sort of central to painting and abstract expressionism. And, you know, there's a kind of iconic Jackson Pollock work where he's sort of got this, his signature kind of drip, and then in the middle of it, he's cut out this kind of amorphous sort of silhouette figure. And it's, you kind of feel like Perminda sort of gone to that and kind of taken it somewhere else. It's very reminiscent of that, where it kind of seems to disappear and then come forward. So it was interesting to think about that in that display in Southampton.
Yeah, also you mentioned this quite intriguing reference to Gottlieb Moritz Strebe. Do you want to say a little bit about that? Because it's a sort of interesting detail about ideas of childhood and how that plays in her work.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's part of work that I've been doing on and off for a few years around. So people who know their psychoanalysis it's familiar to them, because so Moritz Strebe was father to Daniel Paul Strebe, who wrote, he was a high court judge in Germany. And wrote a memoir of his experience of being in an asylum, which was published around early 1900s. And it was controversial in psychiatric circles because he basically accused his psychiatrist of sexual abuse. But he also used the memoir as a sort of defense for being allowed out of the asylum, which he was granted. And Freud then writes a sort of piece around paranoia, which becomes very influential in a number of ways. So Schreber Pear becomes sort of infamous as a consequence of his son's sort of very public, public. I mean, the idea of publishing something so personal, the guy was obviously not well anyway, right? So it's kind of, it's quite a sort of complex document on many levels. And I think at the time people were wondering, do you really want to publish this? Because it's very exposing. But on the back of this, in the 50s, William, I think it's Nederland, wrote a piece on Moritz Strebe and examined his background. So he apparently had been a very famous, well-known educationalist and advocate of health and of exercise, and had written a number of documents and pamphlets on child rearing, which ended up being quite widely disseminated. And I think there were like health clubs devoted to him and kind of set up in his name. So he was very prominent. But what becomes clear in Nederland's, I have to remember whether that's right.
It is right,
Right. Yes. Okay, so he kind of then makes a link between the father's educational pathways and Schreber's mental disintegration. What he reveals is that Moritz Strebe created these prosthetic devices that would that children were expected to wear while they're eating, for example, or while they're, you know, so you have to have a correct posture, and you have all of this kind of rather bizarre sort of instrumental kind of manipulation of the child And so Nederland's sort of thesis is that basically there is a kind of cultural mindset around the child that produces a paranoia about otherness that is there in Schreber's memoirs and leads to fascism.
Yeah.
So in the 50s, the sort of post-Holocaust moment is being kind of psychoanalytically unpacked, and Elias Canetti takes up that argument in the 60s. And so the Schreber case has then become a sort of flashpoint for thinking about paranoia, fascism, and sort of psychic disintegration within a kind of heteronormative notion of a masculine mm-hmm.
And I guess in a way that Pamela Decore's work sits within that, in the way that she's distorting and reframing those ideas of domesticity in the work. I mean, these kind of appended, deteriorated, or lengthened out kind of chairs and so on. Is that, do these kind of things, is this where you're sort of citing this particular thinking, or?
I think, inevitably, when you sort of go and see something, you kind of bring your own set of references to it. And, you know, there is that kind of, you know, the colonial Indian dimension of it, which is one aspect, and violence of the child, you know, with these sort of early pieces that reference the Sikh culture. But I think that, you know, we kind of have a sense of that in our sort of diasporic kind of conditions, that the question of, you know, violence and the relationship of violence to the child is a much more complex thing. And so what I suppose I found interesting in Perminder's work is its connection to surrealism, where and particularly a sort of Bataille view of the child. So the other aspect, I suppose, what I was seeing in Perminder's work was, you know, this sort of, I suppose it's particularly the miniature pieces. So this is a new shift So she's made these sort of chairs. So there's these sort of plinth structures, and then on top of them, she's put these sort of chairs with, and then covered them with felt. And there's a whole sort of set of debates around the miniature in Susan Stewart's book on longing, which sort of tries to think about a cultural history around scale. And it's quite an interesting kind of material culture text. So I suppose that it was interesting to sort of think about the sort of the notion of play and the child and our concepts of childhood, because the whole sort of preoccupation with Alice in Wonderland, that is one part of surrealism, is also a product of a very, very kind of sanitized and Victorian idea of childhood, which never exists, and is a sort of compensation for the brutal exploitation of children as laborers, actually. So, but with someone like Georges Bataille, you get, if you kind of look at some of his sort of writings in the journal document, the child is a source of id, you know, it's kind of all of this sort of untamed kind of dynamics, which include sort of, you know, violence, aggression, hate, rivalry, all of those things. So it was interesting to see that's always been there in Perminder's work. You know, there's always that latent sense of menace, which I've always liked. But because initially when I saw it, it was kind of framed in a sort of Sikh context, I wasn't quite sure how to sort of navigate it. But sort of thinking about the way it's sort of set within that kind of those smaller chairs, it sort of brings in, I suppose, a more overt reference to a kind of surrealist sort of history of the child.
And has she spoken about that herself? I'm just interested, I'm assuming that over the years, I mean, there's numerous interviews that she's given, has she ever spoken directly towards surrealism? Do you know?
Well, I spoke to her about it. And she said that people like Louise Bourgeois and Mona Hatoum have been important to her work. And there are other pieces in the gallery that I didn't mention in my review, which is a set of drawings, which are also drawings of the gallery space, but they very much referenced Louise Bourgeois' drawings. And that is a reference she's very kind of explicit about. And I'm afraid I'm really bad at this. I don't always read artists' interviews. I know I should, but I don't.
Absolutely not.
And so I don't know. It's a good question to ask. I don't know whether she's ever actually explicitly made the connection with tourism. Certainly, you know, her work has been supported by people like Eddie Chambers and Camille Mercer has written about them. So they've been positioned perhaps in much more of a kind of post-colonial Black British context. On the other hand, the references to bourgeois are so obvious, you know, that it's kind of hard to.
Well, in terms of the sewing, the fabric and the weaving, these kinds of more.
All of that, yeah. And the beds. So you know, also sort of just thinking of bourgeois installation spaces where she just creates this sort of domestic environment. She uses doors and, you know, there are some beds. And Hatun probably uses the bed a bit more, the kind of collapsing cot.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a domestic as a kind of torture palace, you know. So the political and the personal, the collective, as a sort of, you know, the psychic has a space that moves between those boundaries in those artist works. You can, you know, I think it's interesting. I mean, maybe she and I should sit down and talk about how much I'm projecting onto.
No, I think it's what for me is interesting to try and, because in a way I'm not. As I said earlier, you know, it's sort of reconnecting with her work after these years. So I'm actually, it's sort of, I'm trying to suppose, think about her fellow kind of travellers in a way. You know, it's interesting to think of it within relation to someone like Mona Hatoum, you know, like other British artists that sort of around the same time. I'm sort of interested because in a way, I'm just trying to think about the context through which she's worked through as well.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I see her as sort of emerging as a 90s artist.
Mm.
And so the way that kind of, you know, the way the contemporary shifts at that moment, you know, there is that kind of obsession with Bataille and, you know, and the sort of debates around the Anne form and abjection and the sense of a kind of fin de siècle sort of milieu of kind of disintegration, you know. So, I mean, I suppose I position her in that partly because it's also my own moment of encounter with contemporary art. And I suppose that's kind of what I saw in the exhibition.
Can I ask about Schreiber, the son? I wondered like whether in writing about, you know, the torture and the sort of imprisonment that he was subjected to, whether in writing about it, it's a sort of like reclaiming of agency, and maybe paranoia and mental disintegration are not the only things that come out of that, whether there's any form of like resistance in there as well.
So just as a bit of a background, I mean, the thing about Schreiber, the case study around Schreiber, so this is Freud reading a memoir and developing a theory of paranoia. But until he does that, it's not seen that there is no analysis of paranoia in Schreiber's, in the psychiatric response to Schreiber. And the psychiatric response to Schreiber is simply as sort of someone who's suffering a delusion of so there's a whole sort of sexual dynamic here. So he thinks he's being, he's having nightly sex with God, right? And he believes he's talking to God, and he believes that he's being also persecuted at the same time, and that God is coming towards him in different forms. And other aspects of that are his psychiatrist, Paul Fleschig. But what comes through, also part of that is, he has periods of time outside of the clinic, and he seems to be well, and then he comes back. And tied into that are moments when he's basically moving towards transvestitism. So he's dressing as a woman, and he starts to have fantasies of wanting to become a woman so he can have children with God and recreate the world, because it's become corrupt and polluted. He wants to save humanity. Mm-hmm. So you can see why there's a notion of paranoia, but it's also what's interesting and why it's been picked up in different ways. And one aspect of the way it's been picked up is that Eric Lantner later talks about is around homosexuality and his suppressed homosexual desire. There is also a desire for his father, So that he has no sense of his father as a torturer at all. It's not there. And I think that's what is being examined by later writers, is that he suppressed any sense of violation by his father, and he's projected it onto his psychiatrist, who's the evil guy, who totally adores his father, who dies when he's young, and then his elder brother commits suicide. So there is no sense in his consciousness of any wrongdoing by his father. It's completely suppressed.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case. Yeah, it's a fascinating case, isn't it? The whole paranoid case of Schreber. But I feel like we may be exceeding the bounds of this conversation a little bit by going down this particular psychoanalytical history route. But if we may move on, if that's okay, to Henry Broom, whose article Pissed Off is in last month's issue. So it's great to have you on, as I know we missed having you on the last issue. But your article looks at sanitation and public art, and the overlooked relations in some ways between the way in which public art functions in relation to homelessness, but also notions of cleanliness and racial purity in right-wing discourse around public space. Shall we begin with, I think it's a great way to begin actually, is your initial reason for writing this article and your experience that led to it? I think that'd be a good way to start.
Well, yeah, I think the story behind that is fairly complicated, but a similar story happened while I was writing it. So I went to go see Richard Serra's sculpture in the Broadgate development, which is just behind Liverpool Street Station. Sort of made my way through the shopping area and then got to the base of the sculpture. And like just as I got there, I saw a security guard sort of tap a device against the inside wall of this ginormous sculpture. I don't know how large it is, but it's very, very tall. I was sort of like a bit dumbstruck, and I sort of looked inside and I saw a little black circle. I ran after him and said, you know, what was that you just did? And he said that it's a sort of a digital security checkpoint, and they tap a device against these black nodes. And it says in this case that there is no homeless people sleeping inside or taking drugs or urinating inside. And there are clear indications that people do that, because there are rust marks down the side, and then there's a kind of drain, and there's a kind of a trail of markings like down to that. I started to think about like what is the link between like homelessness, sanitation, and public sculpture? Then I also looked at some of the texts in sort of artists' reviews and interviews. And one was Yinka Shonabare, and he made a public sculpture. And he speaks about having to change the form so that it didn't create a shelter for homeless people. And this was for London. And sort of, he says that I had to abide by city rules and change the shape of it. And I'm actually in the process of like finding out a bit more about that, because I want to write an article like specifically around that regulation. But so far, having put in a lot of freedom of information requests to about 6 or 7 different councils, they've all said we don't have any specific regulations about not creating shelter for homeless people. But yeah, that's the basis of the article.
Yeah. And so actually, but you start your article in a completely other country. You start in Germany. I kind of guessed the city we're talking about, but you have deliberately left that sort of unclear for various reasons. Do you want to describe this experience? Because I think this is also quite an interesting story.
So I was in the reason why I protect I don't tell the cities, because all the work of art, is because it would be like immediately obvious, like where it is. And so basically it's a artist designed public urinal, and it's a kind of a black shaft, and it's part of a sculpture park. And I went there with some friends, and we were going around a lot of like traditional sculptures, and then saw this one, and someone tried to open the door, and it was first of all stuck, and then they pulled it a little harder, and the door flung open, and there was a homeless person living inside. And yeah, bearing in mind there's no roof on this shaft, there's a grate, which then has a kind of bowl, and then that goes into a tank below, and that's the urinal. So he was living inside this roofless urinal for I don't know how long. And the reason why I don't give specifics is because maybe the museum who commissioned this would find out and sort of start to police this area. And I think the state should be actually providing homeless care, I also don't want to invite police harassment on someone who has got some space that they can call their own for a brief moment.
I mean, I think we see, you know, I think you also touch upon the ways in which architecture and design is, particularly in big cities, in a way, are geared towards obviously antisocial, but also anti-loitering or anti-lingering design. And we've seen that in park benches and other kinds of manifestations in design more and more, or more frequently, certainly. In a way, do you see public art functioning in tandem with these policies, or do you see a kind of tension or interruption, et cetera, through these kinds of commissions?
Yeah, so certainly, yeah, if you look at Yunker Shonabari's commission, you know, he's directly being told not to create shelter for homeless people. But then on the flip side, I looked at the whole starting point for this article really came, you know, a long time back, looking at David Hammond's performance Pissed Off. He actually urinated on another Richard Serra sculpture in New York. This was a sculpture that was collecting rubbish, and it was looking untidy, and it got graffiti all over it, and people started to use it as a kind of like a way to show their just sort of show their displeasure about the city. And he urinates on the sculpture, and it's photographed at the time, and there are a few photographs he's urinating on it, and then he's getting a kind of, he has a conversation with a police officer afterwards. It's not clear whether he's getting a citation or being arrested. It's not clear. But that for me was, you know, a point of resistance, because he says, you know, the reason why I did that is because there's nowhere to go to the toilet in New York City without having to buy a drink. And he sort of makes a statement, and at the end of it, he says, keep the rage going. And I wondered, like, whether, you know, in graffitiing or urinating on public sculpture, these were signs of resistance for people who are excluded from public space.
I just wanted to make a very minor observation, which is sort of more of an anecdote than anything else, which is that my recollection of the Serra piece in Broadgate was that it was, I used to work around the corner in a pub when I was doing my PhD in the 90s, and I would be serving mainly guys from the city.
Yeah.
But anyway, and it was mainly them who would be pissing in the Serra piece, because it was easier than going to the loo.
Yeah.
That's a whole other dynamic.
A whole other dynamic.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the sculpture, the artist designed urinal that I start the article with, that is situated in a park, and it's a park that's, you know, used by homeless people for refuge. But all around there are big headquarters of banks, and they're sort of shiny buildings. So yeah, there definitely is this like close proximity of extreme wealth and then extreme poverty as well that happens like that.
Yeah, and it's not only homeless people who are happy to piss outdoors and you know, it's also a marker of masculinity that, you know, I can do this.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I saw,
we'd like to as well, actually.
Even outside of St. Paul's, there is a in one corner, there is a kind of like almost crucifix form in with these huge spikes on. And I think by the looks of it, it's to stop people urinating in that corner. So, you know, even, you know, there's no sort of holy ground, no place that is not considered, you know, okay to piss on.
Well, also, we cite the Dora Buddha artist, the artist Dora Buddha, who made the work Urine Deflectors, which are these kind of casts in cardboard, and they're stationed around, actually just around Fleet Street area. So again, it sort of speaks to this idea of the sort of banker, wealthy guy coming out of the pub late at night, and I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's a sort of, yeah, there's an equality of usage of the street in a way.
And Vaishnav was talking about
in terms of gender, and not in terms of gender, but
that's across class.
I
wanted to bring Vaishnav in because you were talking about sort of bodily smells and like the response there, because a lot of people's repulsion around homeless people is this kind of it's a smell, and the government response to that is to kind of like try and create clean spaces. And what I draw out in this article is a relationship between like government desire for clean spaces and also government desire for racially pure spaces. And I wondered like how that feeds into like what you were thinking about in terms of like bodily smells and like rejections of that.
I guess it's interesting because he, in both his films, it's very much like he wants you to feel all those things. And obviously that's the kind of opposite of what you're saying with these kind of like local councils and institutions, especially like a friend was telling me about an outdoor installation that she worked on. And the kind of people maintaining it saying, we think there's someone, we think people are peeing here. Mm. And she was like, okay, like, you know, does it really matter? Mm. I guess that's a separate point. But in terms of Boss's work, I think absolutely there's this sense of like, he's not just inviting those sensations, he's forcing you to feel them and to engage with them. And I think in this like, you know, policymakers and people in institutions that are kind of trying to sanitize these spaces, they're trying to stop you from even thinking about that. We can pretend homelessness doesn't exist if it's not in our place. But on the other hand, is forcing you, like you're being constantly thrown out with all of these things. And yes, it's interesting kind of sanitizing people's art and then seeing what other artists are actually forcing you to think about.
Yeah. It occurred to me, Rashna, that the olfactory in Bose's film almost, and I don't know how accurate this is, just a thought I had as you were talking, almost seemed to be a kind of glue that puts together the fragments of memory that are verbal and, you know, acoustic. So that there's something around the olfactory that is, it permeates boundaries. You know, yeah. I think that's also the case for Henry, the work that you're, you know, the questions that you're raising around public art is that that's in a way what its power is. The olfactory kind of bombards us and we can't contain our responses to them. You can't shut your eyes to the smell, you know, it's kind of like there's an otherness that has to be engaged with.
Yeah, and that's played out in regulation because the Tories are putting through or trying to put through some regulations that would basically make it illegal for homeless people or anyone to like smell bad. That could be an offence, as it were. And I don't touch upon that so much in this article, but in the editorial, our monthly's editorial, they look at that. I guess that's Patricia. Patricia says the real bad smell is the smell coming from Westminster. I thought that was a nice image.
Yeah, also brings to mind, I suppose, the sort of 19th century ideals of like walking around with vinaigrettes and sort of, you know, trying to bring out the sort of, you know, sort of returning to that sort of image of turning our nose to the sufferings of others, really. But
that's the point, is that, you know, with Hammond's performance, it's so direct. There's a way in which you can't deny its force, and I think that's important. Like that's what I wanted to draw attention to. This is a possible way to resist the sanitization of space, public space, and you know, demand water, sanitation, health for homeless people, but for everyone, really. And it's funny because these are demands that, you know, everyone should be making, but it's obviously the most poor and vulnerable in society that have it the worst. But these are sort of universal things that we should all have access to.
Does anyone have any further comments to make? Otherwise, we can wrap the show up. Okay, fantastic. Well, it leaves me to say thank you to everybody for joining this morning. All the articles are in the current issue of Art Monthly, except for Henry's, who's in the previous issue, the June issue. But that leaves me to say thank you for listening and enjoy the summer break, because we will be back in September. But have a lovely summer and goodbye.